produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today. World Sporting Anti-Doping Agency continues ban on cannabis despite concerns. International Association of Athletic Federations Council Member and Spanish Athletics Federation President Jose Maria Odriozola raised concern about the ban on cannabis during a roundtable discussion on borderline issues at an international anti-doping symposium organized by the World Athletics governing body. The World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, has defended the continued inclusion of cannabis on its prohibited list of substances, despite criticism that the ban is placing unnecessary strain on sporting federations. Odriozola stated that federations are, quote, wasting considerable time and money dealing with what is essentially a recreational non-performance-enhancing drug, close quote. Odriozola's comments were firmly rejected by WADA's Director of Science, Olivier Rabin, who told the press that cannabis met two of the following three criteria: performance enhancement, possible health dangers, or a contravention of the spirit of sport. Cannabis has been included on WADA's list of banned substances and methods since the list's creation in 2004. Canadian snowboarder Ross Robagliati was temporarily deprived of his 1998 Olympic giant slalom gold medal after traces of marijuana metabolites were found in his body. His medal was returned after Olympic officials acknowledged that cannabis was not a banned substance at the time. Cannabis remains on the new version of the annually revised list, which was approved by WADA's executive committee last month and comes into force January 1st. Irvin Rosenfeld, one of the five federal medical marijuana patients in the United States, was offered a special reprieve from the rules last year when he participated in a Chicago sailing regatta. Irv competes in a specially designed boat that has the ability to be piloted from a wheelchair. Irv pointed out that the WADA rules also cover Special Olympics, Paralympics, and any officially sanctioned international sporting event. This can be particularly troublesome for patients with a variety of conditions who use medical cannabis and also participate in organized international sport. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. First up today, we continue to look at the science of cannabis with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Joining us each Wednesday is Dr. Mitch Earlywine, Associate Professor of Psychology at State University of New York. He's the author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book, Pot Politics. Mitch, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Great to be back.
Great to speak with you on this fine Wednesday morning. Mitch, we spoke with Dr. John Morgan yesterday, and you both frequently emphasized that we need more research into cannabis and cannabinoids. So today, let's talk about how to get into this field. First, how can college students tackle cannabis by writing papers and doing work in their academic setting?
I think the key when you're writing a paper for a class assignment is to understand that you're probably not the only one or the first one who's written a paper on this topic. And the thing that's going to really help you out is to get to the most modern research available. The Normal website is splendid. Paul Armentano is always reviewing the research literature there. If you can get on Medline or PsycINFO and get some of the most recent articles about whatever the topic is, I think you're going to do much better than rehashing some of the stuff that your poor professor has probably heard time and again since the 1970s.
So, Mitch, you've been on the receiving end of many student papers over the years, and this is a good tip in general. You know, why do you think students end up going to the tried and true topics?
I think a lot of them aren't as familiar with some of the new literature and the ways to access it as they could be. Many a reference librarian tells me they're always there and they're happy to help, but they just don't get asked the questions or don't get contacted at all, in part because I think people put it off till too late, and so they're trying to do it all the night before and can only grab the things that are handy.
And there's nothing more handy than normal.org, N-O-R-M-L.org, open 24 hours a day. So, Mitch, what kinds of classes and course studies should you be following to become a cannabis researcher?
I think the key may be to follow your bliss. So even if you don't have cannabis researcher in your first name, so to speak, you still get to do the kinds of things you want to do. So I know journalists, economists, sociologists, members of the clergy who are all also interested in cannabis. And I think the key is to take the classes that are most intriguing to you and then think about, well, gee, how does this relate to my work on cannabis and cannabis law reform? In pot politics, you'll see a whole collection of folks who have a whole bunch of different backgrounds, but who've all tackled this notion of marijuana criminalization from their own perspectives. If you really are a down-and-dirty person who wants to understand the endocannabinoid system, by all means, get in those bio and physiology classes. If you're more interested in dependence and the treatment of problems, psychology would be the way to go. If you want to think about policy, well, economics, sociology, and public administration classes can be the way to go. But again, the key is follow the things that are really interesting to you. This is a long road and one that has got to be something that you can enjoy throughout.
And Mitch, you mentioned the different contributors to pot politics coming from a very diverse working background. Was there some common factor that drew them into this field?
As it turns out, everybody I talked to said that there was essentially something intellectually sparking or something morally sparking for them. So either the idea that somebody could go to jail for owning a plant just made them so angry they just couldn't sit still, or there was something intriguing about the idea of a government that would tell people what they can and cannot put in their bodies, and that suddenly got them off on the philosophy of law in general, and next thing they knew, they were, you know, writing and publishing on drug war topics and things along these lines.
And do you think that students could set this as a goal from the get-go and make it their goal to focus on cannabis as a career?
I do believe this is something that you can plan ahead, and even have high school students occasionally talk to me saying, this is the way I want to go. If that's the case, I think the key is, you know, a strong liberal arts education so that you're a good writer, you're a good reader, and a good thinker, and then following the things that are of most interest to you. You don't have to be somebody working with test tubes or working with addicts in order to really be a master of relevant cannabis literature.
And yet there are some out there who really want to work with those test tubes. Is there some place out there where you can go to get hands-on learning regarding cannabis research?
Right now, I think the thing to do is to just go on PsycINFO or Medline and search the topics that are interesting to you and then find which researchers are doing that kind of stuff. But just off the top of my head, anybody's welcome to come to SUNY Albany and do some work with me on the behavioral aspects. There are folks at Iowa doing a lot of stuff on brain research and magnetic resonance imaging with cannabis. The Harvard and McLean Hospital folks are eager to investigate endocannabinoid system. And then, you know, the obvious ones are overseas, where if you're in the Netherlands and have a chance to look at some of the universities there, by all means, a year abroad is a wonderful educational experience and would be a great opportunity to investigate things that are consistent with cannabis law and cannabis system research.
And Mitch, do you think that travel is part and parcel with this? Does one need to go overseas to understand and have an impact on what's going on here in the U.S.?
In truth, I feel like we need to go overseas just to understand ourselves. I think whether you want to be a cannabis researcher or not, a trip to another country is something that will teach you more about culture than any book ever could. I really encourage folks to travel and get a sense for people from other cultures and people from other parts of the world who don't necessarily have the same values we do.
And Mitch, for those who are already in their careers in a given field and want to turn their focus to cannabis, Mitch, you've published a number of journal reports, so having done it, what are some of the hurdles faced when writing academic papers on the topic of cannabis?
I think it's easy to get paranoid and think, oh, because I'm writing about cannabis, the reviewers are working against me, but that's rarely the case. People just want to see good science, and if you do the things that you know are the best in your field, it's going to end up that you're work is published. It may not be in the very best journal of your research area, but that's okay. Just get the word out there, and then we can, you know, do the best we can with the science that we have. And I'm finding that even the funding opportunities are there if you look hard. It's not quite the same as, say, some of my big grants on alcohol and aggression, which are easy to get funded in comparison, but there are places that are willing to look at any kind of research on cannabis-related medicine, on cannabis and its potential impact on pain or other issues like that. If you just seek and find, by all means, anybody who's really into this should email me, and I'm happy to just be part of the support group. And a whole bunch of us with a whole bunch of different backgrounds tend to email papers back and forth to just keep each other fired up about staying in the field.
Also, is there a small journal just about cannabis, or maybe a college that had proposed themselves to be the future center of cannabis research?
Ethan Russo tried very hard to get a research journal devoted to cannabis and cannabis therapeutics, and it was a real uphill battle. And I think, in fact, it's better for us to try to get into the more mainstream journals, because those are the journals that people who aren't necessarily on board with cannabis law reform might be reading. So I feel like journals like Addiction over in Britain or Psychology of Addictive Behaviors here in the United States are open to these kind of articles, but that's not their main identity, and then that way people can pick it up and learn something new, and it might be the folks who would later adopt a cannabis research program who wouldn't have done so otherwise.
Mitch, let's also look at the other end of this. Is there room for scientists in this field who are interested simply in the intriguing science of cannabinoids, cannabinoid receptors, and the like? Can they be involved in this research without their work being politicized?
I think it's easy to go into your lab and ask the questions that are interesting to you, and then let the media and let the politicizers do what they do. I think it's not impossible, but it's not easy. I feel like the big questions in the endocannabinoid system right now really don't have anything to do with medical marijuana or marijuana law or anything like that, so much as signal transduction and why does our body even have an endocannabinoid system. And those are the kinds of questions that I think any good scientist would want to see answered, and we'll let the data fall where they may. I really don't think there's any empirical question that would be a problematic one along these lines.
Mitch, you mentioned this wasn't necessarily about medical cannabis. Much of this research involves isolated single cannabinoids. You know, how hard is it to get this type of research done and even receive the isolated chemicals?
As it turns out, those things are relatively easily obtainable. Things that are going to block the cannabinoid receptor are available from a number of laboratories now. The fact that we've even discovered, the cannabinoids, I think, is such a wonderful credit to these hardcore basic science researchers who've put this kind of effort in. As far as funding goes, funding is tough for anybody, regardless of what you're studying, but there's definitely a lot of interest in this system, and particularly if you're willing to compare it to, say, the dopamine system or the serotonergic system or other methods of neurotransmission that are popular as well, I think the opportunities for funding are really out there, and in fact, it's a very exciting time for that kind of work.
So, Mitch, just to recap here today, for students or those already in a career field, really the best place to start focused research is online on Normal's website, norml.org.
Absolutely, and then I think the take-home message is start your work early and follow your bliss so that you pursue something that you're going to stick with, and remember to go to the most contemporary work you can get by consulting with your reference librarian and hitting Medline and PsycINFO and the most up-to-date sources of information that you can get.
And don't be shy of submitting to mainstream publications either.
Absolutely. I really encourage that.
Mitch, thanks for all this great info and insight. I really appreciate these conversations each Wednesday.
Super.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is Associate Professor of Psychology at State University of New York. He's author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book, Pot Politics. We have links to both at normalaudios-.com. Next up on the program, we have the privilege of offering the international perspective on cannabis from Sebastian Seville. Sebastian spoke at the Normal Conference in 2006, and while many things have changed in the UK, American attitudes and propaganda still pervade politics across the globe.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Paul and Alan, and everyone here for having me. I'm very pleased to be here. I was here last year, and I very much hope to be here next year as well, if it is here. As I heard earlier, it might not be. It's been a great event, bringing the roots and tops together, which I think was a marvelous title for the conference. And I've been impressed by many, many interesting talks. One that particularly impressed me was Alison Holcomb on the opening morning, and she talked about the importance of sharing our life experiences. So before I just talk about the rather mundane brief I've been given about the UK and cannabis, I just thought I'd tell you how I kind of got to here a little bit. Pretty well to the day or to the week, 25 years ago, I started a 1 to 5 year prison sentence in California for a drug offense. And I was fairly tough and confident in those days, so I settled in reasonably quickly. But I'd been there about a month, and this young kid came into the prison, and he was clearly terrified. And for some reason, he sort of selected me to sort of latch onto to try and help him through the first few days. And I kind of asked him, you know, why are you here? And this was a pretty tough prison, you know, and he seemed very young and quite so naive. And he said, well, me and my friend, we were arrested on the beach with, I then understood the term as a lid of pot, which is quite a small amount, I understood. And so I said, well, how come you haven't been bailed out? He said, well, my parents thought it would be a good idea if I came to prison so I'd know what it was all about. That poor kid, I tell you, 5 days later, I was shipped off to the penitentiary, and I never know what happened to him, but I can tell you for sure that probably ruined his whole life, I can tell you. It took me 17 years to be able to come back to the United States, and I eventually got a visa to come back to actually to attend court in Los Angeles to clear up an outstanding bench warrant. And arrived at court with my lawyer, and the district attorney looked up at the judge and said, we'd like your client to finish off the other 4 years of his 1 to 5 sentence. This was only 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And I looked at my lawyer and I said, she's serious? And thankfully, we had a very illuminated judge up there, and he looked at the big pile of papers, these testimonials, which would allow me to even get back with a visa at all. And he looked at my lawyer and he said, are these real? Are these forgeries? And my lawyer said, no, absolutely. They've been all notarized by the embassy. So he looked over to the DA and he said, what possible use would it serve to send this man back to prison 21 years after the event? And she said, well, you know, we can't send out the wrong message, you know? And he said, well, it's absolutely absurd. She said, well, at least he's got to finish his probation. And he said, well, do you suggest he commutes from London to Los Angeles to see a probation officer? And he looked over to me and he said, $1,500 fine, how would that sound, Mr. Saville, to sort this whole out? And I said, very, very fair, Your Honor. Thank you very much, sir. And just thankfully there was a very decent judge who didn't listen to the advice he was given by the court. The funny thing is, of course, although this is all cleared up 4 years ago, and I've got documentation to show it is, I've been into the country, into the States, probably 12 or 15 times. I'm married to an American. I have family here in California, and I'm still on the wanted list. I came in the other 10 days ago, 3 hours at the airport, and they felt very embarrassing there because they could clearly see that it was a mistake, but it's still there, and I've written to every federal agency, and it's just absurd. Anyway, I thought that would just be a little insight into how I started on this road. Alan on the opening morning talked about effective propaganda, and I think, you know, with us at one end and the sort of un-Christian Christians at the other end, I think we're never really going to convince that end extreme of sort of change. But the chunk in the middle, I think, of, you know, with the right information and stuff, yeah, can be encouraged to change the way they think. But what I have learned is that trying to intellectually do it is not as effective as sort of using some emotive language. I was on a radio show recently with a politician, a senior police officer, on the subject of medicinal cannabis, and I thought I was going to start off by using the sort of, you know, intellectual argument, the science, this, what we've proven, the randomized control trials, et cetera, which you've heard so much about today. But I thought this was no good. And I looked over to the politician who'd been really sort of aggressive and said, so you go home tonight and your 75-year-old mom looks at you and says, you know that bone-crushing pain I've had for the last 15 years, the one that the Demerol, the morphine, the heroin, which you could even get in the UK, hasn't worked for. Well, I found something now that works, and I feel I can live again. Are you going to have her arrested? And he just fell silent, and it just kind of worked a little better than trying to explain the science. Anyway, so cannabis in the UK. I've been asked to touch on this recent rescheduling controversy. So how bad is cannabis? The big hype about cannabis and mental health. So how mad is cannabis? And recent arrest figures. How sad is cannabis? First of all, whatever they tell you about cognitive impairment through smoking cannabis, it surely does not compare to thinking and speaking publicly on interferon. Halfway through my one-year course of this toxic mixture, and I could easily look from you to you and completely forget where I am, who I am, and even what I am. So forgive me for using a prepared statement. If I didn't, you could suddenly be listening to the macroeconomics of why termites like wood or something equally obscure. So I've called my talk Pot Shots from the UK, the vexed question of pot. Trying to make my brief a little interesting, I'll talk about the historical and social trajectory of cannabis in the UK leading up to the present moment, focusing on just a few of the highlights of that history, necessarily, as time is short, I've been informed, and in some of the areas of shadow thrown up by those spotlights of knowledge and power. The gaze of knowledge has been directed at this venerable plant in the course of the last century or so, during which time the British authorities have sought a way in which to deal with the vexed question of pot. And it is a venerable plant. The hemp plant has long historical association with Britain, though for much of its illustrious career, that association was indeed centred not so much on dope, but more on old rope. Indeed, upon old rope, which once rested the imperial fortunes of our land of hope and glory. Long before the spectre of pot-induced madness reared its fuddled head, or the dreadful prospect of disordered youth bestrode the great stage of politics, before our rulers furrowed their august brows over arcane questions of scientific classification, the cannabis plant was already entangled in the problem of the nation's future well-being as a primary source of rope, rope for those ships for which Britannia would come to rule the waves. While opium became the chief produce of British India and the veritable opium of the people at home, the cannabis plant led a quiet, respectful life largely outside of the public eye until the early decades of the 20th century. Much like here, as we heard earlier. Cannabis was not included in the first UK Dangerous Drugs Act of 1920, nor in the propagations made under the Defence of the Realm Act during World War One, which prohibited the use of opium, its derivatives, and cocaine. Water, yes. That's all right, that's enough. Throughout the 20s, however, an increasing social and moral panic began to be generated around the use of cannabis, with Fleet Street, which is the centre of arts of journalists in the UK, reporting that this obscure oriental drug had joined its more infamous forbidden relatives in being employed by dope by British citizens. A few notable cases aroused the interest of the press. Cannabis turned up, usually having been believed by police to be something else, in a number of provincial towns. Instantly suspicious of this hirsute foreign botanical, the police pressed unsuccessfully for the drug to be included in the 1923 amendments to the Dangerous Drugs Act. The Home Office, by contrast, initially adopted a relaxed tone in relation to these unexpected appearances, noting that the place where hashish should become confiscated possessed sizable Arab colonies, and that immigrants could only be expected to engage in these types of vices. The drug's first public appearance in London caused a real rush of press frenzy, when two North Africans were prosecuted by the police for attempting to sell a large slab of it to an undercover officer in Old Compton Street, now the very heart of fashionable Soho. The two gentlemen concerned worked in a local coffee house where they appeared in native dress, and their arrest was just too good for the tabloid newspapers to resist. Maddening dope for the asking, screamed the Daily Chronicle. The others echoed the sentiments, hashish peril, new dope peril, and the new trade in a horrible drug. So the alarm was first sounded upon Britain's shores. In the event, the case failed for the very good reason that cannabis was not illegal, a fact which one might have expected the police to have been equated before they went in. It was the pressure exercised internationally by the Egyptian government, backed with customary enthusiasm by the United States, which eventually led to the legal prohibition of cannabis in the UK. Concerned at the widespread use of the drug within the Egyptian population, there were claims that 70% of inmates in the Egyptian asylums were there as a result of its use. The Egyptian government managed, by means of diplomatic pressure, to bring cannabis within the scope of the 1912 Hague Convention. So right at the outset of UK legal regulation, the spectre of madness was invoked in relation to the use of cannabis. In order to meet its international treaty obligations, that the UK Parliament included cannabis in the 1925 Dangerous Drugs Amendments after a debate lasting 5 minutes. It took place on the 5th of August 1925. As the bill passed through the House of Lords, Viscount Haldane rose to observe that it was impossible to form any judgment of the details of the bill and urged that it should be taken by the House to a large extent on trust. It was. Such was the quality of the scrutiny accompanying the first legal prohibition of cannabis in Britain. The theme of linkage between cannabis and madness is nowadays particularly associated with some celebrated public information films produced by the American government. The famed Reefer Madness represents, of course, the pinnacle of achievement in this area. However, it is an older theme, a much older theme, going back to at least the 19th century, when French and British colonial adventurers in North Africa allowed their psychiatric experts the free run of the local asylums. It is a linkage. It is a linkage which has emerged once more at the forefront of cultural consciousness in the UK in recent years and has become the object of heated controversy. In January 2004, cannabis was reclassified from a Class B to a Class C drug. The system of classification in the UK is itself under review at the present time. Embedded in the UK's 1971 Misuse of Drug Act is a system which supposedly grades drugs according to their potential to impact negatively on the health of individuals and society and claims to be based upon scientific criteria. Whether this is the fact is highly debatable. The judgments are thoroughly implicated in the social and cultural prejudices and myths of all kinds. But that's a topic for another day. The downgrading of cannabis in 2004 was probably broadly supported by the British public, but was always controversial. A number of concerns led to the decision. Chief amongst them was the inordinate amount of police time and resources that were being directed towards arresting people for cannabis possession. It was widely recognised, in addition, that such arrests had little, if any, deterrent effect. A new consensus had formed within the Blair government that its drug policy should focus on those drugs which were perceived to cause the most harm, mainly heroin and cocaine. It was on these that the police were to focus. It was also felt that the classification of cannabis as a Class B drug suggested that to many users into the belief that the law greatly exaggerated the harmful effects of all illegal drugs. The proposal to reclassify was put to the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, the ACMD, the UK government's panel of drug policy so-called experts. They recommended that reform go ahead, and so it did, despite the grave misgivings expressed by the Daily Mail, probably our most reactionary tabloid newspaper.
That was Sebastian Seville speaking at the Normal Conference in 2006. This has been Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to Podshow.com for all the great pod-safe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. podcasting technology of normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.